Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The year was 1939, and some of the top issues of the day included racial strife, anti-Semitism, workers hard hit by tough economic times, and women's rights. Also, refugees from war were trying to reach a safe haven in America, but many in the public feared some would come here to do harm, that German agents might be among them. Sound familiar? Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in the White House. Eleanor Roosevelt was First Lady. And it is Eleanor Roosevelt's life we examine this hour. She was remarkable for the role she played in tackling these issues, undertaking extensive humanitarian work at home and abroad, and often clashing with government policy, public sentiment, and her husband, FDR. Blanche Reason-Cook has just published the third and final volume of her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt called Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. Reason-Cook is a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and Graduate Center at the City University of New York, and she joins us today in studio. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's great to be here.
So again, this is the final volume that you've written on Eleanor Roosevelt, whom you call ER throughout the book. It focuses on the years just preceding World War II and then through the war and after. But let's just begin with a brief history of her early years to set the table here. Her childhood was lonely. Her mother, aloof. You write that she called Eleanor Granny and told her that she'd best learn manners because she was so plain. How did this disregard and even some might say, you know, borderline cruelty by her own mother during Eleanor's young life begin to shape her?
Well, she's really shaped by both parents because Eleanor had a great love all her life for her father. But her father was an alcoholic who died at the age of 34. And one always has to pause alcoholism, the family disease. What is it? How much do you have to drink? And what happened here that he died at the age of 34? So her mother was very cold to her, and her father was really removed from her life. And then her mother dies when she's 8. Her father dies when she's 10. And she's raised by a loving grandmother and aunts, and she's sent away to a school in England, which is really what saves her life.
Marie Sylvester?
Marie Sylvester.
There you go.
Yeah. And I've been telling students, graduate students, you know, there is no biography of Marie Sylvester, one of the most interesting women in Anglo-American history, and in Anglo-American and French history. And it's a marvelous story. She really sees Eleanor Roosevelt's brilliance, and she understands her compassion, and she really, you know, is her primary mentor. And Eleanor Roosevelt comes back at 18 after 3 years under the tutelage of Marie Sylvester, surrounded by you know, the women of the leadership class of the world who adore Eleanor Roosevelt, a changed person. And she spends her life in alliance, in community with women who want to make life better for all people. For Eleanor Roosevelt, the generative quality is to make life better for people in want, in need, in trouble, people just like her own family.
And we'll get into that pretty deeply throughout the hour. Yes, what she does during the war years.
And that is the origins of her life and, of course, what Volume 1 is in large part about.
Yeah. Well, so she and Franklin Delano Roosevelt were distant cousins.
Right.
They married at a young age. What did they mean to each other, at least initially?
Well, initially they meant love and trust and a shared vision of the future. Eleanor Roosevelt, from the very beginning, is actually politically FDR's mentor. You know, she takes him, she works at a settlement house. She takes him to see poor children. They visit the East Side tenement houses. He's never seen poverty before. So she introduces him to the work of Jane Addams and Lillian Wald, these great settlement house pioneers Hull House, Henry Street Settlement, and where Eleanor Roosevelt works, the University Settlement House. And they become activists together. They're partners. He really appreciates her work, and she really appreciates his work. And then, you know, she, when he becomes a politician, she promotes his every step, and she feels she is working to make things better, and he is working to make, and she never doubts that they're basically on the same page in terms of what their vision is, even when he becomes the political juggler, having to juggle the realities of politics.
So in the early years of their marriage, there's a shared love, a shared vision, a shared passion. And then, of course, 13 years in, she discovers FDR's affair with Lucy Mercer. Who was she?
Lucy Mercer was a very beautiful secretary. She was Eleanor Roosevelt's secretary. And Eleanor was heartbroken that FDR, essentially betrayed her. Yeah. And she offers to divorce him. He promises never to see Lucy Mercer again. But that whole story, which is so much in the paper all the time these days, you know, I mean, how can you trust women? I mean, how can you trust men in politics, because the women are there? And so they have an arrangement. And the arrangement is she has five children. She doesn't want them to grow up in a tragic home. She wants them to grow up in basically a united home.
So she doesn't want them to experience what she experienced growing
right.
up.
Right, right. And she, their partnership remains the essence of their relationship. But, and Eleanor Roosevelt says that she can forgive, but she cannot forget.
How did she manage to bury what she could not forget, and move on to, you know, to forge this one of the more enduring and powerful partnerships in American history?
There's a section about grief in this book, about how Eleanor Roosevelt would sit in front of the statue of grief in Rock Creek Park and contemplate. Do you have the page?
I do,
that?
Actually. Yeah. It's on page 3 of this book. And she never wrote of the pain this affair caused. At least that's
right.
my understanding from the book. But yes, there was this statue called Grief. And
commissioned by Henry Adams, the sanctuary of mourning and resistance that had been created by the sculptor Augustus Saint Gaudens to honor Adams' late wife, Marion Hooper Adams, known as Clover, a pioneering woman photographer, linguist, learned, what we used to call blue stocking, a gracious and popular hostess whose translations and research were important to Henry Adams's early histories. He never credited her work. And that's really important for Eleanor Roosevelt, too. FDR never publicly thanked her for her ideas.
And speeches,
many of which became his policies subsequently. And that's a theme throughout the book. When she learned of Henry's affair with her friend, Elizabeth Cameron, she committed suicide. And Eleanor Roosevelt would sit for hours, alone and in despair, imagining the future. She did not want her five children, who then ranged in age from 3 to 13, to suffer the cold embrace of her own mother's legacy. And she says she will forgive, but never forget. And on her desk, she kept a copy of the poem Cecil Spring Rice had written about this bronze statue that she visited repeatedly over the years. And she always took new friends to sit with her at Rock Creek Park and contemplate this statue. And it was among her bedside papers at her death. And these words, which ring so powerfully today, "O steadfast, deep, inexorable eyes, set look inscrutable, nor smile, nor frown, of tranquil eyes that look so calmly down upon a world of passion and of lies.
So publicly she was able to set aside this betrayal, but privately she never was able to do so.
Right.
Okay.
But it's that world of passion and of lies that we see unfolding around us in politics so much everywhere.
75 years later.
Yeah. Hmm.
We're going to get more into the relationship between Eleanor Roosevelt and her husband, their working partnership, and the issues that they confronted as the war in Europe unfolds. In 1939, Blanche, you write that over 10 million Americans are unemployed, recession-like conditions persist, and every domestic program that Roosevelt supported had come under vicious attack, and ER was subject to vitriolic commentary. Tell us about that.
Well, I think people don't realize how viciously attacked she was by politicians, by journalists like Westbrook Pegler. And every word she said, people would make fun of her teeth and her voice, which was apparently very high on occasion. And they would make fun of her. But what they really hated was her vigorously progressive vision, and especially her civil rights positions. And so it really is important to realize that every word Eleanor Roosevelt said against lynching, against racial violence, against segregation in the 30s and 40s, every word is in J. Edgar Hoover's FBI file. He hated her, and there's a whole movement. Of course, the Dixiecrats dominate dominate Congress at the time. So that's really one of the big features of she goes forward and FDR wants to juggle, but he never silences her. He says, go forward, do what, say what you need to say.
Well, hard to believe in this day and age, but in that era in the 1930s, she pushed, as you said, for the need for a federal anti-lynching law. And you write that efforts to pass such a law had a long history.
Right. And there are six times Congress actually debates making lynching a federal crime, and it never passes. It never passes. This is one of the astounding realities of our history. Eleanor Roosevelt, throughout the war, encourages respect, dignity, equal rights, and finally the integration of troops, black and white.
We're going to pick up on the story of Marian Anderson as well after the break. Blanche Friesen Cook is in studio with us. She is author of the new book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. And we are taking calls at 888-477-9499, tweets as well at WHYY Radio Times. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Blanche Wiesen Cook, who is the author of Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. It is the third book in her trilogy, biography on Eleanor Roosevelt. 20 years in the making, Blanche?
A little bit more.
Yeah.
It was started in 1982.
So, I'd like to get, again, back, kind of staying for a moment on the era of Jim Crow and the work that Eleanor Roosevelt did for civil rights in this country. Tell us the story of E.R. Marian Anderson, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and Constitution Hall, which the DAR owned tax-free.
Well, the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to give Marian Anderson space to sing. And here she was, this most notable opera star around the world, and she was not allowed to sing. They then applied to a public school in Washington, and she wasn't allowed to sing in that auditorium. And so Eleanor Roosevelt and Harold Ickes had a really wonderful idea. Why don't we allow her to sing, give her space? you know, in front of Abraham Lincoln's statue on federal property, and everybody will be welcome. It will be a magnificent event, and it was a magnificent event. 75,000 Americans, black and white and all shades of the rainbow, were there to hear and be enthralled by Marian Anderson's concert, which, you know, gets repeated regularly on TV. It's really the most astonishing thing. But what people have to deal with, and what I have to deal with, is, except for the notables on the stage, seating was segregated at that concert, and most people stood. And then they could stand together, but you couldn't sit together. And that's how insane our culture was in those days.
Was there pushback initially to the use of constitutional?
There was a pushback, and Eleanor Roosevelt resigned from the DAR. When she resigned, it became a subject of great controversy. Somebody told me that her aunt was forbidden from visiting here in Philadelphia because she supported Eleanor Roosevelt's resignation of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and her sister wouldn't speak to her for 2 years here in Philadelphia because the DAR stood by its segregationist policy and split so many women in the organization.
You know, and again, it's hard to comprehend some of this in 2016, but back then, back in the late 1930s, in again the era of Jim Crow, you have a first lady who's taking a strong and very unpopular stand.
Absolutely. And she, when she has Marian Anderson and Mary McLeod Bethune visit the White House, and Eleanor Roosevelt would always greet Mary McLeod Bethune at the White House gates and escort her into the house so she wouldn't be in any way insulted, would take her arm. And this was, you know, the subject of tremendous awe and vitriol. The press, people attacked Eleanor Roosevelt for this. And then she works, and then there's a big movement to end the poll tax. Virginia Durr, D-U-R-R, in Alabama, by 1939-40, says, why don't we end the poll tax? So, and literacy tests, which were a sham.
Yeah.
When I taught at Hampton Institute in 1963, which was an historically black college, I failed a literacy test. And the way you failed it is because you were associated with that, you know, so these were shams to prevent African Americans and their allies from voting.
Sure.
And here we have in the 21st century, Reverend Barber in North Carolina just succeeded in winning a case to allow black people to vote in North Carolina after there was some effort to disenfranchise all the people who had registered to vote.
Echoes of the early 20th century.
Yeah.
Still.
Here we are. 100 years later.
Well, as you also mentioned earlier, Blanche, Eleanor Roosevelt worked to help desegregate the armed forces,
right.
Segregated at the time. You tell a story of Eleanor, and I believe it was a soldier, and an ice cream cone.
Yes. Eleanor Roosevelt goes in to a black encampment, a black base, and there's a group of soldiers standing around eating ice cream cones. She goes over to one, and she says, may I have a bite of your ice cream cone? And she takes it, and he's just staring at her.
What was his reaction?
And she takes a big bite of it and gives it back, and she says, well, that didn't hurt at all, did it? And, you know, everybody applauds. And that's Eleanor Roosevelt saying, hey, you know, we have to share this world, and we have to share what's good in it.
Remarkable.
And then this war will have meaning. This war will have meaning when things are better for everybody. That's her statement throughout the war years.
So she tackled civil rights. At the same time, right around this era in history, Kristallnacht happens in November of 1938. Nazis vandalized Jewish homes and schools and synagogues. Thousands of men are sent to concentration camps. And FDR condemns the rising tide of anti-Semitism in this, in not only abroad, but in this country as well. Soon after, there's a refugee crisis, and immigration restrictions are in place in the U.S. The voyage of the St. Louis, what happened there?
Well, that's one of the most dramatic moments in 20th century history, because this ship filled with refugees is going up and down, and it's reported on the first page of the national press. The ship filled with about 600 refugees is not allowed to land anywhere. And the king and queen of England, Queen Elizabeth and her husband, are here to get some sort of popular image of the king and queen so we can have an Anglo-American alliance, so we can end the military restrictions, so that we can build a defense mechanism to support England. And both things occupy page one, and there's political silence about the SS St. Louis, and it goes back to Europe filled with
men and women and children
who are not allowed to land anywhere in North America. And Eleanor Roosevelt is really heartbroken. And it gives the Nazis a big message. One, there might be an Anglo-American alliance, which Eleanor Roosevelt will hope might give Hitler pause. And two, on the issue of Jews, we have nothing to say. Don't even think about it. And Eleanor Roosevelt vows never to let that happen again. And the next time a ship is stranded, the Kwanzaa, Eleanor Roosevelt says that ship must be allowed to land, and the 80 people on board who have not found a home in South America, they can be here as my guests. And the Kwanzaa, the people on the Kwanzaa are taken in. And a man named Breckinridge Long, and this is one of the great mysteries of FDR's presidency, a man named Breckinridge Long, who is in charge of the State Department's issues regarding personnel. He's in charge of about 70% of State Department offices, and they went to Groton together, and they went to Harvard together. They're old buddies, and he goes crazy. These people are dangerous. I have final words about who is admitted in, not Eleanor Roosevelt and her, you know, dangerous friends. And FDR says okay and gives the power over, the complete power over, to Breckinridge Long. And one of the great mysteries is, why didn't FDR fire Breckinridge Long? Eleanor Roosevelt says, but Franklin, you know, he's a fascist. And FDR says, don't use that word. He knows he's a fascist, but he is in charge.
What was the public afraid of?
Well, FDR was afraid that folks would think this was a war for the Jews, and then it would limit its popularity, it would limit the danger. There was so much anti-Semitism.
But there was also a fear that there might be German agents among the people.
Well, there was fear that there might be German agents. There was fear there might be communists among the Jews. And one of the reasons, I mean, one of the themes throughout the book is there's so much, you know, refusal to act against the Nazis, because the primary target of Hitler are the communists, socialists, unionists, and the Red Scare is already underway in the U.S. And so the equation, Jews, communists, that's really a very big issue.
So you have refugees that the American public is fearful of. They're trying to escape Hitler's advances in Europe. And of course, fast forward to 2016, and you've got the issue with Syrian refugees in this country, and you know the various proposals by the different candidates, Trump, Clinton. the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, it's a great tragedy because what we have is so many, you know, it's like the Muslims are the Jews of today. Who are they? They're people escaping the most horrible violence. We're looking at 64 million refugees today. That's even more than during the Shoah. It's just an atrocious situation. And instead of havens, camps are being destroyed. France just destroyed, you know, the big shelter. And it's a great tragedy, a great global disaster.
So 75 years later, we have not been able to kind of corral the concept of fear and figure it out and move forward.
And Eleanor Roosevelt was very clear about this, and it's what she fights for all her life. We are not going to have peace until we have economic security, education for all, jobs for all, dignity for all. That's it. Health care for all. And that, you know, what becomes the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is something she is crusading for all her life, especially during the war years.
I'd like to get back to, again, just preceding World War II. As we talked about, there is, you know, some open anti-Semitism in the United States. FDR decides to nominate Harvard Law professor Frankfurter to the Supreme Court. And he had initially planned to wait until Justice Brandeis retired. So as you write, there wouldn't be two Jews on the court at the same time. And yet Franklin Delano Roosevelt wasn't necessarily an anti-Semite. Could you explain that? Or was he? Or did he struggle with it? And did Eleanor Roosevelt struggle with it as well?
I think they both struggled with it.
In her close circle, there were people who said things like her very close friend Hick.
Right.
Lorena Hickok.
Right. I think they both struggled. They all struggled with anti-Semitism. The origins of my work on Eleanor Roosevelt is because nobody who had written about Eleanor Roosevelt until the Lorena Hickok book came out in, you know, I think it was 1980, 81 by Doris Faber. And I called Joe Lash up and I said, and Joe was a friend of mine who had blurred my Crystal Eastman book. This is a book that should stay in print forever, and you get to be friends with people who blurb your books that way. And I said, what's up with you not having Hick in your work? And he said he hated her. And he hated her because she was a bigot. So, and Eleanor Roosevelt was initially something of a bigot. She writes to her mother-in-law, the Jew party was appalling. But then she changed, and she changed profoundly.
What prompted the change?
She met Jewish people that she really admired, Bernard Baruch, among others, Eleanor Morgenthau, of course. But the anti-Semitism was part of the culture, and she really transcends it. It's really fascinating. At some point, Eleanor Roosevelt and Bernard Baruch, one of the mysteries of her many friendships is Bernard Baruch. After FDR died, Baruch really becomes one of her primary escorts. They love to dance together. They go to theater together, concerts. And at some point, she writes to Esther Leib, have you heard? Bernie has proposed marriage. Isn't that controlling?
That's an interesting perspective.
It is, really.
Obviously, she didn't accept.
No, yeah. But it's very funny. But the bottom line is, while, you know, the U.S. is dominated during the war by Dixiecrats, the Democratic Party is Dixiecrats, the vast majority of the U.S. population, German-American, Irish-American, you know, and 30% of the U.S. population is German-American. So that the whole question of war and anti-Semitism is within the Democratic Party is connected.
Yeah, and there was a fear that Christian America was under attack.
Yeah.
Let's talk for a moment about some of Eleanor Roosevelt's, her relationships and possible romantic liaisons. We don't know a whole lot about that, but who was Lorena Hickok in her life?
Well, she was a great journalist, she really, I argue in Volume 2 that these letters do indeed mean what they seemed to mean.
Yeah. That there was a romantic relationship.
There was definitely a romantic relationship. I can't wait to lie down beside you and take you in my arms.
And these are Hickok's letters.
Well, these are Eleanor Roosevelt to Hick.
Okay.
Okay, and we know that Hick burned a lot of letters after Eleanor Roosevelt died. So these were the tame letters, and they tell us a lot. But then Hick is also very important to Eleanor Roosevelt because she says, look at all these long letters about your day you send to me. The whole world would like to know about your day. And that becomes Eleanor Roosevelt's My Day column. And I deal with all of this in Volume 2. So that they have a friendship that lasts forever. By 1936, the romance is really over. But they remain friends for life. And Hick lives in the White House. They're very close.
What did FDR think of this?
Well, Missy LaHand is also living in the White House, and Eleanor Roosevelt treats Missy LaHand, who's very important to FDR after Lucy Mercer, as her second wife, treats her with respect and dignity and affection. So, you know, the White House
had an understanding.
Yeah. The White House is filled with their special people. And Earl Miller is in and out of all of Eleanor Roosevelt's homes, the White House and her home on 11th Street, which is, you know, I mean, and, you know, Earl Miller in the early days, I think they might have had an intense friendship, maybe romantic, maybe not. But, you know, I created in Volume 2 a category, why not, given that this is all going on around her.
We'll talk some more about Eleanor Roosevelt in just a moment. We've got a break coming up here on Radio Times. Blanche Wieson-Cook is author of the new book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and here with us this hour, Blanche Wieson-Cook, who is author of Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years, which is the third book in her trilogy, her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. She's here with us in studio, and again, if you'd like to give us a call, 888-477-9499. So, Blanche, describe the relationship between FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt at the time of the presidential election of 1940. Well, the election's looming, and he's considering an unprecedented run for a third term. He didn't consult her about this, did he?
He didn't consult her about it. And
is that unusual?
No.
In the relationship?
Well, it looks like he didn't consult her. That he made his decisions, and sometimes she was the last to know. But she supported his decision. In this case, in 1940, he wants Henry Wallace to be his running mate. And Henry Wallace is, of course, this great progressive. And the Democratic Party is they don't want Henry Wallace.
He's conceived to be a little bit out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really kind of a progressive socialist. And, you know, the Bernie Sanders of 1940. And so Eleanor Roosevelt is called upon to go to Chicago and, you know, calm down the delegations. And she does that. And it really wouldn't have happened if she didn't go. And that's the essence of their relationship. FDR says anybody will tell Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, anything. He trusts her to carry the torch. He trusts her to be his ambassador. And he trusts her to tell him what is needed and what is wanted. And that's Eleanor Roosevelt's great question. Everywhere she goes, tell me, what do you need? What do you want? And then 1940, for me, is very important for Wendell Willkie, because FDR and Wendell Willkie actually become allies, and FDR sends Wendell Willkie around the world, where he has an epiphany that we all need to deal with right now, which is everything that happens anywhere affects everybody everywhere. We are all one world.
But before this happens, before their relationship takes a turn for the better, you write that for all the abuse and vitriol and violence, the two campaigns followed a gentleman's agreement to keep some explosive items out of the press. So before we get to that, you know, the two campaigns, you know,
were not tame. Right, right.
You know, and perhaps, I mean, can you compare them to what we're seeing today?
Well, there were Wilkie's guru letters. Is that?
That's
guru letters. And then there was an affair with a very famous journalist.
Some of this stuff didn't come out, though.
Right. I mean, didn't come out.
There was a lot of angry back and forth between FDR and Wilkie. And as you write, vitriol. But they did agree to keep, I guess it's Wilkie's relationship with a journalist out of the press. And the fact that Henry Wallace, as we mentioned,
had guru letters.
So his perception was of somebody who was really kind of out far afield. So, but I guess the question is, can you imagine such discretion today?
Well, unfortunately, there is no discretion today.
Yeah.
And I think this... This election, though, is really a new low in lies. And, you know, the trumpeter is just, I mean, I don't think we've had anybody quite so crude ever running for president. We've had crude people like that in office, like McCarthy. But this is kind of a scary time. And one has to say Eleanor Roosevelt's advice to women in political life running for office, you cannot take anything personally. You cannot bear grudges. You cannot get discouraged too easily. Women who are willing to be leaders must stand out and be shot at. More and more they are going to do it. More and more they should do it. And her two observations, since men hate women with power, every woman in public life needs to develop skin as tough as rhinoceros hide.
So even though, just want to pick up on a point you made a moment earlier, even though there was anti-Semitism, there was Jim Crow. There were the refugee issues at the time in the late 1930s, heading into 1940. Some of the candidates who were considering running for office, and even before them, the tenor of the conversation was not as vitriolic as we're seeing today.
A lot of those issues really weren't discussed. Mm. You know.
Okay, I was just curious about your perception, because when I was reading your book, I thought, "Wow, you know."
Yeah.
Again, I just felt that the more things
The more things change, the more
they
stay the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right.
Absolutely.
December 7th, 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and the U.S. becomes involved in the war. And again, there's more fear. At home, Japanese nationals are now considered enemy aliens. So tell us what happens next and how Eleanor Roosevelt responds.
Well, that's really one of the great tragedies of FDR's administration, his executive order to remove Japanese Americans from California and put them into camps across the country in certain misery. Eleanor Roosevelt really opposed that was just astonished by that executive order, which remains forever an atrocious thing that happened. And she visited the camp. She encouraged the young people of the camps to go to college. She got many scholarships for the young people to go to college, and she encouraged the young men to join the military, which they did and became, you know, among the most really awarded and bemedaled heroes of the war. And her effort was to humanize the situation once it happened, and she had no control. She couldn't stop it.
Was she angry with her husband?
she thought this was really one of the great blunders of his life.
At one point, she asked him if they might adopt a Japanese-American family.
Yes, that's
can imagine
amazing.
The conversation between the two of them.
He said the Secret Service would never permit it, is all we know that he said. I mean, that's all she quoted that he said, but there must have been much more to that conversation.
You talk about her, I guess she coined this herself, her Griselda moods.
Yes. She would plunge into depressions and really get cold. Trudel Lash once said that when Eleanor got cold, you know, the room would turn to ice. She would get silent. She would take to her bed on occasion. When she came back from her Pacific trip, it wasn't a Griselda mood, but she visited all these hospitals and all these war zones in the Pacific. And she was a great hero. At first, the military didn't want her there. The military resented her being on that tour, but she made the troops feel so much better. She had four sons in the military, and everybody she met was like her own son. And she just boosted morale so that ultimately the generals think of her as a hero. But when she came back after that devastating tour, she essentially had PTSD and needed to recover. But she just kept, you know, activity energized her.
And that's
what pulled her out. So the more depressed she got, the more work she did, and then the happier she became.
In the book, you describe a Paris, and this is at the time, of course, where the war is developing, where the tricolor is replaced by the swastika. Italy has declared war on France and Britain, and Eleanor Roosevelt wants to be part of an aid effort. She wants to join a rescue team. She's you know, has enormous talent. She's fluent in a number of languages, and she has international friendships, but what was she thinking? She was first lady, after all.
She really wanted to be part of the action. She hated to be sidelined and not given anything to do. She wanted, you know, she thought she could be a war reporter at least and a correspondent, but she wanted to be in the action. And FDR, you know, thought she would be, of course,
kidnapped. Sure.
And held for ransom, and it would be a disaster, or she would be killed, targeted. Finally, he encourages her to go to London, and she goes to London during the Blitz. And her trip in London during the Blitz with the bombs, you know, falling, and the great tragedy of the, you know, that moment in the war and all that she did and all that she learned in London about, you know, how to help people. What we need is we need a new movement. And this is what Eleanor Roosevelt's great contribution is. It's not just politicians making things happen. We need movements. We need to go trooping for democracy. We need to have it clear that there needs to be a GI Bill of Rights. There needs, at the end of the war, everybody gets supported, education for all. Eleanor Roosevelt at one point says, I can give you full employment and 100% literacy, one teacher, five students. Imagine that at this moment when we're closing public schools. And then here we are in Philadelphia, the home of Leopold Stokowski. And Eleanor Roosevelt is so in favor of sports and music. Music, the universal language. And she greets the youth, Stokowski's youth orchestra. It goes on tour for South America.
She was everywhere.
She was everywhere.
She's a force of nature.
Yes.
Did she sleep much?
I think she slept about 4 hours a day. She would go to bed sometimes at 3 or 4 in the morning After the day's events were over, she would write her journal and write dozens of letters. And then she would wake up at 6 or 7 in the morning, and she would do exercises by radio. She did all kinds of exercises in the morning, which I think is terrific. She rode her horse, and she walked in the woods. So she, you know, she kept in shape, but
And she also worked. We're running short on time, and I'd really like to get to a couple of important points about her. She worked for women's rights in the workplace.
Absolutely.
Wrangled a mayor in Massachusetts. What
right.
happened there?
In Massachusetts.
Was it Massachusetts?
I'm not sure.
Okay. He was the one who said something about women and yarn.
Oh, I don't remember that story.
Okay.
Forgive me.
Well, if I can find it in my notes, I'll pull it up as well.
Okay.
So why – this has been a labor of love for you, Blanche Wiesen, for
right.
decades,
yes.
the early 80s. What is it about Eleanor Roosevelt that has inspired you to spend so much of your life immersed in hers?
Well, I really think she has given us a vision for what we need to fight for and how we need to fight. You know, she organized as early as 1924. She starts to organize women's committees for equal work, for equal pay, and for equal power within the Democratic Party. And then she does trooping for democracy, that concept that it's not enough to depend on politicians or greed heads to do your bidding. You have to organize. And you have to organize door-to-door, community by community, block by block, to get your wants and your needs known. And we need to do that because full employment, 100% literacy, you know, Bernie Sanders called for free public college education. Eleanor Roosevelt called for that in 1943. Everybody should have tuition-free public college education. Everybody needed to be trained. Not everybody needed to go to college, but everybody needed to be trained.
And she also called for desegregation of public
and
schools.
Desegregation.
Was it 20 years before
absolutely.
Brown versus Board of Education?
1934. We all go ahead together or we all go down together was her speech in 1934 when the teachers of America supported the end to segregation.
Okay. Well, I just pulled up this story just so we can, pass this along to our listeners. She irked the mayor of Northampton, Massachusetts, William Felker at the time, who ordered married working women to resign.
Oh.
And his quote was, attend to your own knitting. And I'd read this, maybe in the New York Times. The response was, how can any woman knit without talking? So... I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that
she kind of Mary.
She
right.
was everywhere.
She was everywhere.
She was. So at the end of the day, after everything Eleanor Roosevelt accomplished, including we didn't get to the United Nations.
And
really,
the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Yes. We got about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Why don't you touch on that?
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights remains a challenge for Americans to ratify the Economic and Social Rights Covenant. We've never even had a conversation. And when Hillary Rodham Clinton becomes president, I think there should be a movement to get her to ratify. And Eleanor Roosevelt was told by Truman, no, don't support economic and social rights. Those are Soviet initiated. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, you can't talk human rights to people who are hungry. So here we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a model of what needs to happen for the future, for the planet, for the world. The guarantee of peace and justice, dignity for all.
Blanche Wiesen Cook, it was a real pleasure having you on. And thank you so much for your characterization of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you so much.
Blanche Wiesen Cook will be at the Free Library tonight at 7:30. She is author of the new book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962. And as always, when you get the chance, check out our Facebook page and podcast. whyy.org/Radio Times is the place to visit. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.